Hi, everybody. Program note, barring holidays, occasional family days, which we all need to have, we now post this show every day. We used to be weekly. Now we're daily. We pull no punches, so look for it. Truth Bomb, number one. The U.S. government and the Western media's reaction to this attack we saw in Moscow was, in a word, weird. Just was. Truth Bomb number two. Are the Moscow attack suspects terrorists? Think about this. Or are they mercenaries? This is an important distinction that could make a world of difference, and we're going to ask. Truth Bomb number three. Finally, the UN Security Council has declared ceasefire now, and Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, has canceled his trip to the United States. Connected? We're going to tell you. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact. You know, I think sometimes the best way to analyze a story is to just make a good comparison. So let's do this. This is the famous headline in the French newspaper Le Monde after the 9/11 attack on the Twin Towers in New York. You see right there on the right, where it says, "We are all Americans." We are all Americans on this day after that attack. I mean, that was a sentiment of unity and condolences at the time, all throughout the world. Russia, by the way, was no different at the time in its reaction, as President Putin expressed his condolences personally to President George W. Bush and then visited the United States to meet with government officials here. That attack in Moscow this weekend, it was both calculated and bloody, a lot like the 9/11 attacks in that sense, and it targeted specifically civilians, just regular people. That is why one would have expected to hear some kind of statement from Washington, right? From this very place where I'm bringing you this newscast from, a statement that expressed some kind of grief, condolences with the people of Russia, maybe even an offer of support to the people of Russia, even if we have differences with Russia. But instead, what the U.S. immediately did is captured in this headline, and here it is. They basically came out and didn't say, "We are all Russians today." They said, "Ukraine didn't do it. Ukraine didn't do it. Ukraine had no involvement in this thing whatsoever." And they came out with this right away. I mean, first of all, no one at the time had said that they did. So it seemed peculiar. Why this mad rush to say, "They didn't do it, they didn't do it"? I thought, as I watched it, and I think as a lot of my peers and colleagues who watched this geopolitical trifle watched this, they thought, that's kind of strange. I think weird might even be the right word. Why such an early declaration? Why was the U.S. directing the information to begin with? Why was all the information flow from this story that occurred in Russia coming out of Washington, I thought. Of course, we also have to ask, where was the offer of condolences that you would expect in a situation like this? Wouldn't that be the first thing that you would do? It wasn't. And then finally, after the attack, a U.S. official did make a comment. But it seemed weird also, to me anyway. You tell me what you think. Look how tortured White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby appears. I remember I was watching him in the moment Friday as this was happening. And when he finally appears and he addresses the attack, watch him. Watch his demeanor. Notice how careful he is choosing his words, being very careful not to show any support, not to show any sympathy for the Russian people or for Russia or for the Russian government. Instead, he seems to suggest he only feels bad for the specific individual victims who were in the concert hall. Listen.
Our thoughts, obviously, are going to be with the victims of this terrible, terrible shooting attack. And I think, you know, you look at that video, if you have, and you got to recognize that there's some moms and dads and brothers and sisters and sons and daughters that haven't gotten the news yet. And this is going to be a tough day. So our thoughts are with them.
Didn't that seem odd to you that he's only talking about those specific victims and never said anything about maybe helping Russia, supporting the Russian government, doing something for the people of Russia, feeling bad for the people of Russia? Oh, there are people there who could be uncles and aunts. I mean, and by the way, part of the reason this is so interesting is what else did it have to do with Russia? In fact, as Kirby continues talking, he even alludes to the fact that Russia has lots of enemies. What does that mean? Why did he say that? Is he somehow suggesting that Russia somehow brought the carnage on itself? U.S. officials were also quick to announce that ISIS was solely responsible for the attack, citing that ISIS had claimed responsibility. The claim of responsibility was a statement published by an ISIS-affiliated news agency, Amaq, on Telegram soon after the incident. Now, did it provide any proof or any reason or any details, as they usually do after an attack like this? More often than not, a lot of these terrorist organizations thump their chests. We did it. Here's how. Here's why. There was none of that. Just curious. Again, it's a very definitive U.S. response from a statement that did not seem all that definitive. And one would expect in a situation like that, we as journalists, most people who investigate these things would normally at least analyze it, question it, wonder if it really does come from there. Well, there was none of that. Of course, by now, the Western media, led by the New York Times, has already cemented this thing as the definitive narrative. I've been reading the Times just today, and they have all kinds of stories today confirming that U.S. intelligence officials, they saw this coming. They had warned Russia that this was about to happen. But did they really? And if so, did they share details with Russia about that? That narrative is also now very much in dispute. It's true. There was a security alert. Let's be clear about that. There was a security alert. I looked it up. I found it. There it is. I put it there for you. Or our producers and Tyler, the director, is putting it up so you can see it. There it is. It was sent out by the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, which does warn of a possible attack by extremists. It says Americans living in Moscow should avoid gatherings, including concerts. But this thing was put out March 7th. Kirby and company made it sound like they put it out yesterday or last Thursday, the day before the attack. This thing went out just before the Russian elections, and it only lasted for 48 hours, and they took it down. So did they really know something, or were they just issuing a typical pre-election advisory to U.S. citizens that they put out in almost every big city in the world just prior to an election? It's just a good question, that's all. In fact, many of these questions that are being raised at this point have to do with just getting to the truth. Getting to the truth by not jumping to conclusions. You know the old expression, leave no stone unturned. Well, that's kind of what you got to do in a situation like this. And for that, questions need to be asked, for example, about the accused or to the accused. Many terrorists tend to take their own lives after attacks like this. These guys did not. In fact, there they are in court. See that? Those are the, apparently they're from Tajikistan, as they claim, or maybe we should say as they say. Claim implies that maybe they're lying. I don't know if they're lying. One of the men allegedly says that he was hired and he was paid very well. So were they recruited? And if so, who recruited them? And if that's the case, then they're really not terrorists, right? That would make them mercenaries. Shouldn't we know that? Were they, as alleged, heading to Ukraine? And if Ukraine wasn't directly involved, as the United States has made clear over and over and over again, were they possibly then indirectly involved? So these are the questions, right? Could Ukraine have been involved indirectly? These answers will not be known overnight. But again, the suspects are all still and presumably talking. They are in a court of justice and will likely at some point be telling their stories as the world waits to hear what they have to say. Joining us now to talk about this is international human rights attorney Dan Kovalik and international relations and security analyst Mark Sloboda. I tried to make the case there that usually in a situation like this, there's a lot of queries, there's a lot of questions, there's a lot of doubt, there's a lot of people trying to confirm and nail things down. Why does it seem to me, maybe Dan, I'll start with you, that somebody is not trying to ask these questions and, dare I say, jumping to definitive conclusions?
Yes, well, it reminds me of William Shakespeare's line, "Thou doth protest too much." The fact that the U.S. was so quick on the draw to say Ukraine didn't do it makes you wonder whether, in fact, Ukraine did do it. I think this warning that the U.S. gave a couple weeks ago seems suspicious. And again, it seems like they did not pass on any information to Russia. I mean, that's what the Russians are saying, that they did not.
I tend to think when I read this, I went and looked at it right away. As soon as I heard about this, I went in the old Googles there and went back and read this security alert, which is what it's called. And it was put out on the 7th, and they said it was only going to last 48 hours, and it was to warn about extremists that could possibly do something prior to the elections. That's what it seemed like to me. I'm not sure it had anything to do with this thing. It makes me think that maybe, we put that out. Let's bring that out now and say that we knew about it. I don't know. What do you think, Mark?
John Kirby made clear that warning was unrelated to this attack. He spelled that out exactly. There are a lot of holes in the U.S. narrative that they have been peddling since minute zero on this, that ISIS-K is solely responsible and our U.S.-backed proxy regime in Kiev had absolutely, totally nothing to do with it. These fighters, they made no political or religious declarations either during or after in detention. They claim that they were paid money for doing it. When they attempted to escape, they didn't head to Central Asian states or the Caucasus. Instead, they drove right for the Ukrainian border.
Is that nailed down? Is that nailed down? Do we know that? Has that been confirmed?
Yes. Yeah, they were captured in Bryansk, 100 kilometers from the Russian-Ukrainian border as the warning went out, of the car to look for, because they went in the car that they had arrived in. Actually, not a very good methodology. Hmm. They threw away their weapons. They did not attempt to fight. They didn't die to the death. They didn't try to die as martyrs. They tried to run and climb a tree. One of them did, but they didn't attempt to fight. They made no declarations. They were attempting to go into a conflict zone, which should be a heavily defended border on both sides. The Russian president, in a speech, announced that Russian intelligence had information that there was a window that was supposed to be opened by the Ukrainian side of the border to let them in. This is why the Russian government feels that this claims of ISIS-K being involved is a fig leaf of plausible deniability, and that the real perpetrators are the Kiev regime's intelligence operatives and their foreign backers.
Well, let's be fair. We don't have the smoking gun on this, but I'll tell you what, just listening to what you just said, I'm thinking, you know, the three of us have covered and watched and read about and analyzed terrorist attacks for the better part of the last couple of decades. And we know what fits the profile of the typical suicide bomber slash terrorist. It does seem clear to me from what we know that, Dan, these guys don't seem to fit that profile. They may be more like mercenaries, they may be almost more like mercenaries than terrorists. You get my drift?
Well, you used a key word in there, and it's suicide. I was just listening to an interview with former CIA officer Larry Johnson, and he said, you know, if they were truly ISIS, there's two things that we would expect. One, that they would be, you know, religious zealots, and that they would honor Ramadan and therefore not carry out such an attack during mm-hmm. Ramadan. But number two, they would not be captured alive. Mm-hmm. They would they would just as soon be killed resisting.
Mark, I got to come back to you because I'm thinking about this now. Pardon me, Dan, I didn't mean to interrupt you on that statement, what you were about to make, and I'll come back to you in a minute. This statement that was put out by, in fact, the Russian media, that one of the men has admitted that he was paid money and that he was recruited. What are you to make of that?
Yeah, that really doesn't surprise me in the slightest, because once again, they don't fit the profile
yeah.
of a standard suicide bomber. Are a standard, you know, Wahhabist zealot attempting to achieve martyrdom through killing some infidels. And there are a lot of questions about ISIS-K, you know, ISIS Khorasan as an mm-hmm. organization to begin with. The American journalist Seth Harp, who writes for Rolling Stones and Harper, he noted on Twitter, the leader of quote-unquote ISIS-K was a contractor at Bagram, the U.S. Air Force base in Afghanistan,
Uh-oh.
Then worked security for drug lord Rachel Dostum, a top CIA proxy and the vice president of Afghanistan at one time. He later worked for Amrullah Saleh, chief of the Afghan intelligence unit, literally the CIA's right-hand man in Afghanistan. And he points out that it's right there on the Wikipedia page. So what he's suggesting clearly is that ISIS-K is and has always been a CIA cookie cutter, a cutout. And I can't help but notice that ISIS-K's activities have mostly been involved attacking the Taliban, Pakistan, and Central Asian states. In fact, the Taliban put out a statement condemning this attack. They expressed their condolences to the Russian people, and they pointed out that they've been battling ISIS-K for a decade.
I can't help but ask you guys about Tajikistan. I'm trying to understand what the connection. I think a lot of people over the world might be scratching their heads trying to figure out how this all comes together, if it does. And that's what we're going to talk about when we come back. Dan Kovalik and Mark Sloboda will continue this conversation after the break.
Counter the Russian state control narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays, on est en France quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Отверженных. Нам уже от нее не деться. Ветер степной пахнет смертью, мятой и медом. Мы пьем за любовь, за правду, за наше счастливое детство. Пьем, не чокаясь, из гильз от гранатомета.
Вся русская литература – это война. Поэзия там, где больно.
Победим, у нас нет других вариантов. Иначе эта вся свора размотает нас на тряпки. Так что нам придется побеждать.
А Okay, welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's get right back into the show. In fact, with Russia in the news, I wanted to mention something else. As the investigation on this attack in Moscow continues that we're talking about, there's an update on the economic front as well. Apparently, British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has made a bold move. He's announced an end to UK's reliance on Russian gas. If you want to prove you're tough on Russia, it doesn't sound any better than to go out there and make this point, if for no other reason, from a standpoint of public relations, right? We don't need the Russian gas anymore. But it's not quite as simple as it seems. Here's the kicker. The UK's new source of liquefied natural gas is really still coming from Russia. What he is announcing is that he's not buying directly from Russia, but rather from a middleman who gets it from Russia. That middleman is none other than the French. It's a French energy company. So what that means is that Sunak is boldly distancing himself from Russian gas due to geopolitical tensions, but is actually indirectly still supporting Russia and Russian gas and Russian and its energy sector. You can't make this stuff up. Back to the question at hand, and I wanted to get back to you guys on this. Dan, Mark, I don't know which one of you wants to grab this, but talk to me a little bit about Tajikistan. There's been a lot of palaver going back and forth over the weekend, even from President Putin on Tajikistan. The president of Tajikistan says there's nobody from Tajikistan. These people are from other planets or something like that, which I quite didn't understand either. I don't know. Dan, you want to get the first crack at this to help us understand what's going on here?
I'm going to defer to Mark on this. I think he's probably more of an expert on this.
Please, Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, there has been a radical Islamist, a Wahhabist movement in Tajikistan, which is a poor majority, Muslim majority, Central Asian state. But its heyday was in the 1990s. There was essentially a brief-lived civil war over it. There were also a number of Tajik fighters in both Afghanistan and in Syria fighting with jihadi formation. So it is not unbelievable. I believe that's probably why four Tajiks were picked for this, because there is a degree of plausible, you know, deniability that they could be involved in an ISIS-K attack. However, these four individuals, there's no evidence of any type of religious radicalization, which you would believe would be the primary motivation for conducting such attack.
Yeah, and the big difference here is if the motivation were money, that's not usually the case with real believers. I mean, I do believe that there is not that big a distance between a patriot and a terrorist. Depends on whose viewpoint it is. But there is a big distance between a terrorist and a mercenary. And if these guys took money, that makes this a whole different story. By the way, there's another story I got to bring to your attention. And Dan, I want you to help me with this one. There's this. The world has finally witnessed a significant diplomatic development this week. And the United Nations Security Council has just passed a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. It had tried before, but this time it made it stick. And what makes this resolution particularly noteworthy, we think, is the unprecedented decision by the United States to abstain from the vote, a move that has sent shockwaves through diplomatic circles as well. Why? Because the U.S. has always voted nay. They have always been opposed to any talk of any kind of ceasefire. They've always defended Israel and its attacks without the release of hostages first. This abstention has not been without consequences. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, incensed by the U.S.'s position, apparently has canceled his scheduled visit to the United States. He was even expected to meet with President Biden. Not anymore. How much of this is a real dispute, and how much of this is politics, Dan? What's going on here?
Well, I think there's a few things going on. I mean, first of all, I think Joe Biden is hearing footsteps. He knows that his presidential campaign is in trouble because of his support for Israel and Gaza. You know, he's now received the moniker Genocide Joe, and that's coming largely from his own base. That is not very helpful. So I think he's looking for a way out of this bind. With that said, I don't truly believe the White House is pushing for a ceasefire, nor will it. I mean, the fact they abstained, that's better than vetoing it, but they did abstain. And meanwhile, are they going to keep sending arms to Israel? My guess is yes. And so what does that mean when he keeps sending arms to someone involved in a hot conflict.
You say that, and the reason I'm jumping on that thought process that you just shared with us is because I'm thinking, couldn't they stop it altogether if they stop sending arms? Where else is Israel going to get those arms?
That's what everyone has been saying. The U.S. could end this today with a phone call, and they haven't made that phone call. They don't need a U.N. Security Council resolution to do that or to end this. You know, we know that there's been, every 35 hours the U.S. has been sending arms and ammunition to Israel during this conflict, which Israel desperately needs. So, again, if they stop the arms shipments, then I'll believe it. But until that happens, I'm sorry, while I see something positive about the resolution, I'm not that optimistic. And I'll just add one more thing. I saw that the Russians wanted an amendment to say it was a permanent ceasefire, and that was rejected. So what does ceasefire mean? I don't know. I don't know, to be honest.
Yeah, like we would say in sports, a break in the action. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Mark. Really insightful stuff, and I'm so glad that we had you guys on to share this information with us. Mark, we'll be looking for you again this week as this story continues to play out. Before we go, I want to remind you of our mission, which is simple, really. De-silo the world as best we can. Got to stop living in these little boxes where you only believe what you and your friends believe. Truths don't live in boxes. Truths everywhere. I'm Rick Sanchez. I'll be looking for you again right here, where I hope to provide a direct impact.